Thank you all for coming. What a wonderful turnout. As I've been reminding people all season, this is the 30th year for Columbia Forum. Some of us have been here for the whole thing, and we're grateful to those longtime fans. I'm Matt Winters from Coast River Business Journal and the Chinook Observer. We are one of the sponsors of Coast, or of Columbia Forum, along with Daily Astorian, Cannery Pier, KMUN, and Craft 3. We really all, I think, appreciate Chris Holden and his crew from Baked Alaska for a delicious dinner tonight. This has got to be one of our record crowds. I don't know if how many of you remember some of our early presentations with people like Ken Burns and Dayton Duncan back in the Lewis and Clark bicentennial days, which was a wonderful opportunity to hear international speakers and get new trails constructed at federal expense and all sorts of little gifts like that. John Kitzhaber came right before his announcement of a third term. That was another big one. And so Carl Marlantes, our wonderful guest tonight, is right up there with some of the rock stars of the Pacific Northwest. He was a guest with us, I don't know, a dozen years ago? No?
Eight or nine.
For his Vietnam book, Matterhorn, which we commend to your attention as well. Carl, as is reflected in Deep River, his new book, has incredible deep connections with our area. I'll let him tell you the real high points, but he was born here in Astoria and delivered by a famous physician who many of you will recall. You know, Deep River celebrates the heroism of ordinary working people, something that we all too rarely get to see in literary works and in fine arts, and it's particularly notable that these ordinary working people are some of the heroic immigrants who settled this area. I belong to a group on Facebook called American Finnish People, which I commend to all of you with even the tiny little smidgen of Finn that I have, because it reveals this vast network of these incredibly loyal Finnish people who make this amazing fan club and support group. And so there are these wonderful testimonials to Deep River there. I don't know if you've seen it, Carl, and I plucked out a quote or two, but I think I'll leave it for you to find them for yourself. But the man is worshipped in Finn American circles. So with that, I'll turn it over to Carl. I'd like to make a few closing remarks about our upcoming events when Carl's talk is done, and you'll all have opportunities to ask him some questions, and then I'll hop back up before we say goodnight. So with that, let's welcome Carl Marlantes.
Okay, does this work? Okay, good. Yeah, I was born in St. Mary's Hospital, right a few blocks from here, and I was walking through the Henningsgaard mezzanine, and Dr. Henningsgaard is there helping my mother deliver me, and sort of all these connections. And the other connection to this theater is my mother sold tickets at the little kiosk down below, and she used to make extra money by cheating the sailors who didn't know the currencies. But she said it got even because she said if at the end of the night they did a count, and if the count didn't match the ticket sales, then it came out of your wages. So pretty difficult times. This was in the 30s when she was selling tickets here at the theater. And I grew up in Seaside, but my grandparents lived here, and I thought I'd talk tonight a little bit about my background, because a lot of people say, well, how did you get involved in writing a book like this? And a little bit then about the actual book itself, what was sort of you know, a lot of the thinking behind the book, the the relation that it has to the Kalevala. And then I thought I'd read, you know, 3 minutes, don't worry. And then we'd open it up to questions. So my last name is Greek. My father's first language was Greek. And my mother, although she was born here, didn't speak English until she went to the first grade. So her first language was Finnish. Excuse me. But her father, Leif Erikson, and when I was a kid, I thought that this road out here was named after my grandfather. But he spelled it L-A-F-E, Leife. And, of course, he spoke Norwegian. And my grandmother, who spoke Finnish, then divorced him and married a Swede. So there were, honest to God, there were five languages, Greek, English, Swedish, Finnish, and Norwegian in my house. And my brother coined the phrase cultural linguistic schizophrenia. And so I don't know any of them, although I can pass the cookies in any language. But in Hyvä-ilta, and you know, I'm that good. So for you Finn speakers here, and I've never understood why we call it Finn, and in most written places called Finnish. Somebody, we speak Finn. You know, I don't know where that comes. Why it's that way. So what was interesting about that time period, and it's different now, is that my grandparents, the Greek side and the Finnish side, were worried that we would grow up with accents. They wanted us to be Americans. And so any time that my brother or I started speaking one of what we called old country languages, they would jump on us. Oh, speak English, speak English. So I can hear it, and it's sort of in my ears and in my heart, the sort of lovely, it's almost a sing-song, sort of the Finnish sort of cadence, you know, and it's nice to grow up with that. But the household, it really was cultural schizophrenia. I mean, we took my Greek grandmother to Portland once a year to the Greek Orthodox Church. Yeah, yeah. And of course, my mother and my aunts, it was the only time they ever put on perfume was to go to Portland, and my brother and I'd choke in the back of the car because it was just reeking with perfume. And and we would go to the Greek church, and I mean, you know, we'd walk in the door and the priest would be up there and the incense going and the chants going and people shouting at my grandmother, Sophia, so long, I don't see you, how's the babies? You know, I mean, then you go to the Lutheran church. You know, that was a household I grew up in, and so that was pretty interesting. My grandmother, and she plays a large part in my imagination in this book. The first image that I had for this book was 20 some years ago. I woke up in the middle of the night with an image of my grandmother looking out of her window at the Columbia River. And I thought to myself, I said, why am I thinking of grandma looking at the river? And she had a relationship with the river. She was an atheist. She was a communist. And I asked her if she ever had any thought that there might be a deity. And she said, well, if there is one, it's the river. And so I thought about this woman looking at the river, which has that connotation and that resonance. And what was her life like? And that ended up being the last scene in the novel. So it's interesting how novels sort of get generated from little bits like that. But she was a communist, and I can remember we used to come up and visit because we lived in Seaside, and we'd be coming to Astoria, you know, often. And I grew up thinking that the Daily Worker was the local Astoria paper. It was on our table all the time, you know. I mean, that's not the Seaside paper, it's the Astoria paper. And she was in the IWW. She was, you know, nothing like Ino, my character, nowhere near as romantic. She was just way down in the trenches there. But I had Boy, there's the hail. I had another sort of moment that got me thinking about the novel, talking to my grandmother. I went to college in the 60s, and it looks like there's enough people around here who might remember this Joan Baez song, "I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me," you know. And, you know, the 60s icon, Joe Hill and Joan Baez. And so I came home from Yale, and I talked to my grandmother. I said, "Grandma, you were in the IWW. Did you know Joe Hill?" And she literally took a step backwards. "That son of a bitch." And I'm like, whoa. I mean, you know, he's famous. He's an icon, you know. What? And she said, you know, she said, "We would work so hard to try to get guys to carry the red card." And the red card was that you were a dues-paying member. I think it was $5 a year or something like that to get the pay organizers to go out and get the work done. And if you held an IWW card and were found out, you were fired. I mean, we take for granted the laws that we have today that protect workers, and they're, you know, some of them are under fire, I think. But back then, I mean, if you were a member of the IWW and it was found out, you were gone. And not only were you gone, you had to have your family go too. You wouldn't get a job anywhere within 18 counties of here because you would be blacklisted. You would virtually have to leave the area, change your name or something. I've never competed with hail before. I'm losing. She said that we would work so hard to get these guys to carry the card, and then Hill would, you know, say he's going to come up and you know, to a rally, and he was a great parodist, and he's very important to the movement. But all these guys do have some clay feet. She said that he'd show up, and cops would show up from every corner of the state, and he'd sing some songs, and everybody's scared to death because the police are coming there. And she said that he'd leave, and there'd be red cards torn up, thrown on the ground. That'd be the end of that. And she said 2 years of organizing down the drain. So I thought, wow, that's a different view of Joe Hill, you know. And I said, that's going into a novel, you know. So my grandmother was important that way. And I don't know why, I'm just reminded, I go back to this cultural schizophrenia. So she's a communist, and one of the things that is funny to me is that, you know, if I say she was a communist, oh, radical. She made apple pie, and she, you know, I mean, worked on the nets and canned fish down here at the local canneries, and she's just grandma, you know. I mean, communist, I mean, it was just like, to her, it was like being a Republican. I mean, really. I mean, she's, you know. So my Greek Orthodox grandmother was very Christian, very Orthodox. I mean, you know, when she told me, she said, you know, when I go to heaven, Papu will be there to meet me. And, you know, so my mother and my father meet just before World War II at a bowling alley in Spokane. And they decide to get married. And it's an anathema in the Greek Orthodox Church to marry outside of the religion. That means you go to hell. All right? And the day of the wedding, my Greek grandmother went outside of the church in mourning clothes and sang the death song for her son, who was going to hell because he's marrying this Finn. And my Finnish grandmother refused to go because she said it was opiate of the masses and she didn't want anything to do with this bullshit. So that's how my mom and dad started off life with, you know, this cultural schizophrenia. I fished with my grandfather. We fished out of Scandinavian Station. Again, you think about how tough these people were. We have no idea of what it's like to work the way they worked. And here's a story of my grandfather. I mean, the reason that I went to work for him when I was, I think it was in my eighth grade, he had his legs crushed with a log booms. He was working up on the Lewis and Clark here, and the boom came together and crushed his legs. He worked by himself, pulling the logs, and he crawled to his car and drove himself to the hospital when they amputated one of the legs. And so so there he is with his wooden leg, and that's how I started fishing with him. And I have to tell you, one of the great regrets of my life is that I did nothing but piss and moan about working out. Oh, God, all my friends work in restaurants, and all the girls come and see them, and they can eat all the ice cream they want, and it's warm inside there, and we're out here, and I'm getting seasick, and it's raining. And I mean, all I can imagine. He said, I came to America, and I got this, you know? Yeah, so... that was Axel, and I named the character in the novel after my grandfather Axel. And the other thing that was important to me about my childhood that it is reflected in the novel, and one of the motivations is that many of you can remember this, but when I was in grade school, you could feel the log trucks go by because the floors would shake. Then, because they didn't get paid by the hour, they got paid by the load, and they barrel-assed through town, just, you know, one log on a truck, one log. That's all they could carry, and you just feel on the log truck going by. And Sid Smith, who was the cop, I'm pretty sure they had a deal with Sid. They said, "I'll let them go through town." Today, there's like 40 logs on the same size truck. And the bravery of these people, and I mean, the old growth, they took it down by hand. I mean, my uncle John Pablo was a high climber, and he said that sometimes a couple of days to get one of these big trees down. Just think about this, 14 hours, 12-hour days. Just boom, you know, one guy went and went, and then you know, chop, and they would. It was about every 2 seconds, boom, boom. They were ambidextrous. They balanced on springboards that were at least 8 or 10 feet above the ground, because with this tree fluted out like that, it just didn't make good lumber, because the lumber would be curved, so they wouldn't. They would cut it off above where the flute was, and they would stop. Where the first limbs came, because they just figured if it had knots in it, it wouldn't be worth doing. It's unbelievable today. Even when I was a child, they would leave spruce in the woods that didn't have 12 grains to an inch. And they make guitar tops out of that kind of stuff now. But it was, it's junk wood, no carpenter will deal with that. It splinters, it's terrible stuff. And The irony of this work and the danger, I mean, this is dangerous work. There was no OSHA in those days, and those cables would break and they'd fly around. And five of my friends lost their fathers when I was growing up in Seaside. That's a tiny little town. And I would guess once a year somebody died in the woods. The irony that the old growth forest is gone. It's gone. I mean, you have to go to, you know, a national park to find any old growth anymore. And it was gone. The peak cut in this county was 1972. So we were still cutting old growth, but it was just technology. First you started near the water, so you could haul it with a horse, and then pretty soon you could haul it with a steam donkey, and then you could haul it with railroad trains, and then you could make roads and haul it with trucks, and then finally helicopters. And it was just the increase in technology. Finally, we got to the last bit of it. And then it wasn't like, it just tailed off. I mean, when it was gone, that was it. It was gone. And so I was struck by the irony of the bravery and what we were left with. Another aside, which I deal with a little bit in the novel, is 72 men died building the Grand Coulee Dam. And we go like that and turn on a switch and get electricity. 72 dead to build it, and a line, you know, around the block to fill their places. That was in the late 30s. Not that long ago, you know, historically speaking. So we've come some distance. So that was sort of the motivation, my my family background and fishing with my grandfather. I never logged, but I grew up in the logging town, and everybody else around me was logging. And we used to go out to the shows and, you know, try and watch, and they'd try to shoo us away, and we'd hide in the woods. And it was very fascinating. It's fascinating stuff. I mean, it really is. And the other thing that moved into this book that's important to the structure of the book is a couple of things. I achieved, I think, the height of my nerddom when I was at Oxford. I took a seminar in something called Old Norse Poetic Diction. I mean, just the name sounds like, you know, it's the height of nerddom. And Emily Dronke was the professor, and the class, I think I was the only one that didn't speak three dead languages. It was just an incredible group of people. And her title was the Sigmundsson Professor of Ancient Icelandic Antiquities. Only at a place like Oxford could you get something like that. And I was very blessed to be in there with her, because she was an incredible scholar. And it was lovely, because this incredible scholar, I mean, world-renowned, she spoke Old Norse, spoke Old Icelandic, spoke Old Irish. I mean, she was amazing. She would serve you cookies. She was very English, you know, and tea and everything at a great time. And I got to reading the old Icelandic sagas, and Egil's saga, Njal's saga. These were the sagas that the basically Norwegian settlers, Vikings of Iceland, and they were written down about the 12th century, I think. And there's one in particular called Laxdala Saga, and it's about the settlement of a valley, Laxdala, and a little settlement, and about a love triangle. And I thought, you know, it would be really kind of cool if I could just take that saga and move it to my home, the Northwest, just, you know, have a saga that was here. And I tried, you know, very hard to sort of get the sense of saga when I was writing the novel. And the opening, the cadences are a little bit along the lines of da 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 da, da, because that's that is the Icelandic verse form that they use a lot. And it's the same verse form from the Kalevala. And that's the other thing that was really very important to my sort of fiddling around with this novel. That da, 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 da. Longfellow read the Kalevala, and that's where Hiawatha came from, by the shores of Gitche-Gumee. And it was translated into English in the 19th century. And it wasn't even put together until around 1835. And at that time, Finland was under the control of the Russians. And they were trying to Russify the country. And they really just wanted Finnish to get stamped out. You couldn't use Finnish in governmental discourse, that you had to learn to speak Russian. You could speak some Swedish because the Swedes used to own the area. There was no Finland, no country of Finland until 1917. There were Finnish people that lived there. But a young doctor named Elias Lönnrot, a Swedish-speaking Finn, the Russian government sent him out to the far eastern province in the boondocks. I mean, you had to sort of pay off some of your medical expenses by working for the government for some period of years. And he was sent to the Kaleva district. And la it means from the place of in Finnish place naming. So Kalevala means it's from the place of Kaleva district. And he began to notice the old songs, because these people hadn't been really touched by either church too much. I mean, the Orthodox Church in the eastern part of Finland, the Lutheran Church in the western part of Finland, both churches tried very hard to stamp out the old ways. And in this very far remote district, they hadn't quite done it yet. And he began to notice that there were all these songs that were sung. And I actually witnessed this when I was about five. So this would have been about 1950. At Suomi Hall, We would go there Fridays and Saturdays, and my grandma and grandpa would go there to dance, and they'd bring blankets, and they'd put my brother on with all the other kids on the side of the wall, and we'd run around until we got tired and then clunk out, and they'd pick us up about 1 in the morning and carry us home. It was a wonderful, wonderful sort of feeling to that. But there were a couple old men, and they did a performance where they would link arms and look at each other very fiercely and sing a song back and forth. And that was the old, old style of singing Finnish. And it's very stirring, and especially if you're 5, because you don't know, are they going to wrestle or what are they going to do? You know, I had no concept of what was going on, but once I learned what it was, I remember it. He alone wrote, witnessed this, and he started to collect these songs, and he began to see that there were characters in the songs that reappeared. And modern scholars think they were probably related to very powerful shaman that were remembered in the folk music from way back. I mean, before writing, probably before the Finns even had a written language, but it had survived in these old songs that Lonro collected, and he put them all in one book and called it the Kalevala. And there are, characters like Väinämöinen, who was an old magician, and there's the magic smith Ilmarinen, and these names are familiar if you've read the novel, because Ilmari is a blacksmith, and he has a Sampo manufacturing, and the Sampo was this magic, nobody knows exactly what it was, but it's some kind of a mill that ground out prosperity, sort of like the Greek and Latin cornucopia of prosperity. And other people think it's related to the North Star grinding, wheeling around in the sky. And all these characters, I was struck by it. I said, well, this is my heritage. And it was also very important to Finnish identity, because the Finns began to use the Kalevala as a touchstone for the Finnish language. And there was a big revival in the 19th century of the Finnish language, sparked by the Kalevala. And a lot of Sibelius's music, The Swan of Tuonela and Kuuluriki. A lot of his music is inspired by the Kalevala, and it was very much a touchstone for Finnish independence. Lonro didn't have any idea that that's what was going to happen with it. So I had the great idea that I would bring the Kalevala to America. And I ran onto the shoals of reality, because there's no structure to it. I mean, it's not like, to the Finns, it's the same as the Táin to the Irish, or the Song of Roland to the French, or the Odyssey to the Greeks. But it doesn't have a narrative structure. It's a collection of songs. And so I tried to make a novel out of the first attempt, and I was like, this isn't working at all. But I kept the characters, and so many of the characters are directly related to Kalevala characters and carry some of their characteristics. So that much of the novel is sort of related. And when I first started to write it, I made a 58-page outline. For those of you who are authors in the room, you know, Do you outline? Yes, I outline, because especially in something as complex as this novel, I don't know how anybody could do it without outlining. But if you can, you're a genius, and there are people like that. It was 58 pages, and I have to laugh because I got going, and I write by hand because I have this theory for me that if I'm using the Microsoft Word, I'll click click. Tick, 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 tick. No, I don't. Tick, tick, tick. So I'm always sort of self-editing if I'm using Microsoft Word. If I'm writing by hand, I'm too lazy to go back and, you know, write it out. So I just keep going, you know, and I think it's good because I get into the zone. And just again, my view of art and of literature is that it is a spiritual discipline if you're doing it right. There's commercial art, commercial literature, commercial fiction, but then there's, you know, literary fiction. And I think it is connected to the spirit, because you get into the zone, and I would forget who I was. In other words, the ego moves out. And the great example of that is that nobody knows very much at all about Shakespeare. you don't really know who he is. You can't figure it out from his plays because he's not there. He's letting this other stuff come through him. And that, I think, is a big part of what goes on in writing and also other forms of art, music. Because sometimes I would just sort of like wake up and I'd be like, my God, here I am, it's, you know, middle of the early 21st century and not Finland in 1896. It's a wonderful feeling when you get into that zone. So I'm writing away, and it's getting bigger and bigger, and I'm writing away, and I transcribe it with Dragon software. You know, you can speak into it, and it's not real good. At least I couldn't train it very well. You know, I know comes out I space KNOW, but it's better than, you know, transcribing it all by hand. And so I finally got it done. I beat my rear end off to get the deadline, and Morgan Entrekin is the president of Grove, and he's my editor, and it was 350,000 words. All right, that's big. I sent it in to Morgan. Total silence from New York. 2 weeks goes by, 4 weeks goes by, 2 months goes by, not a word from New York. I thought, oh God, this is really bad. And finally, after 10 weeks, 2.5 months, I got a 6-word email from Morgan. Great stuff, too much of it. You gotta have a pretty thick skin to deal with these New Yorkers, you know. So I cut 150,000 words. That's a novel in itself, yeah. And so it was, I worked hard on this book, and I feel really sad because I threw whole characters out. I mean, because if you throw a character out, then you get to throw out the character's spouse and 3 or 4 kids. I mean, you can, you know, there's a whole lot of words go out if you throw a character out. And it came back. I mean, I said to Morgan, he had lunch with me. I said, but Morgan, I said, Anna Karenina's 351,000 words, which it is. Eddie looks at me, he says, Carl, I could never sell Anna Karenina today. I don't know if that's true or not, but I can understand why he thinks that. So anyway, it came out to 700 pages, 320,000 words, which is slightly bigger than 220,000 words, slightly bigger than Matterhorn, which is 211. So not too bad, but I promised Morgan my next one would be really small, and he's very happy about that. So I thought maybe what I'd do is I'll read just one passage, and then we'll just open it up for people to ask questions about the book. The passage I chose, I mean, one of the major themes in the novel deals with an Inuit woman named Vasutati. And Vasutati is, in my mind, there was an Indian woman living in Seaside, again, when I was a kid, whose name was Jenny. I think Jenny Mitchell, and she was related to Cowboy, who was the Chinook chief that was here in the late 18th century. So, and everybody said, "Oh, she's an Indian princess." I mean, I'm not quite sure she was a princess, but I would go and look at her. I mean, this is so weird. I mean, but I'm a little kid. Come on, and it was, wow, here's an Indian princess, and I would ride my bike up to where Jenny lived and to watch her, you know. And it was like, so she's sort of, so Indian Jenny is what we called her. She sort of became Vasutati. Vasutati's role in the novel is twofold. One is that she's symbolic, again, of what we've lost. The book's a lot about loss of the old growth, loss of the Columbia River. Columbia River is a series of lakes. There's no river. And there's 180 dams on the system. And the only stretch that's still the way it was before the dams is the stretch that runs through the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. So I'm not sure that's a real winner either. But so the irony of what we've lost, and one of the things we lost is our local Indian culture. I mean, we've lost it. I mean, people are trying to revive it, but and Vasutati represents that. And she also represents, for Ilmarie, a alternative to evangelical Lutheranism. Ilmarie is a serious Christian, and I take that seriously myself. And but in his course, his character arc, so to speak, is that it becomes tempered by mysticism, by direct experience of God, as opposed to a faith experience of God. And so Ilmarie is an important character in that regard. And Vasutati is, of course, the medium for introducing him to the more mystical side, the more direct experience side of religion. And also, it's very symbolic as the basket weaving. It's the whole culture, the whole understanding of the Native Americans, and that's passed on to Ilmarie's daughter, spoiler alert, who dies. And all the knowledge that Vasutati taught her goes with her, and that's when Ilmarie throws the wands on the grave. That's the end. And Rauha, who's a steely, glinty Finn, I love her character. Yeah, she gets two bits of basket for that, two bits of basket. Just, again, our culture clashing with that culture and dealing with that. So this passage I'm going to read to you is Ilmarie is just walking from his friend Ulico's house, and he's trying to get Ulico to marry his sister because he doesn't know what to do with Aino. And he walks by an old snag, and everybody in the book walks by this snag, and they all see it differently. And this is the way that Ilmarie sees it, and this is the first time that he meets Vasutati, and it's a little bit about the loneliness that he feels and a lot of guys felt, because back then, I don't know the exact numbers, but it could have been like 10-1 men to women. I mean, I think it was a very, very unbalanced that way, and they were, and then to find a Finnish girl was also even more difficult, and that's all part of the novel too. So he said goodbye to Ulico and set out for Ilmahenki, which is the name of his farm. He passed the grave of Ulico's wife, buried next to a copse of dogwood. One of the poignant things I found in the research is that if you asked somebody in 1895, if you asked a woman, how many kids do you have? She would answer, 6, 3 living. The common answer was 5, 2 living, because they lost so many children. It was just such an ordinary part of life. Again, we forget just how dangerous it was and how brave people were just to have children. I mean, women to have children. I mean, it's just incredible. 6, 3 living. So anyway, here's Ulico's wife who's dead. Ulico had asked him to read the burial service. The nearest pastor was in Astoria, and although he came, he couldn't always do so. Just a half a mile from Tapiola, Ilmarie passed a huge lightning-struck snag, over 20 feet tall, whitened with age and scarred black from the fire. Ilmarie thought of God's wrath striking down from heaven. Why would God make a man prosperous enough to lend someone money, that's Ulico, and then take away his wife and baby? Why would he give and then take away Ilmarie's own baby brother and two sisters? Why was there hell? He thought of burning, screaming with pain forever. How could God be so cruel? But he had sent Jesus to save him, so he wasn't cruel. He was just. He decided to stop thinking, because no one should question God. When he reached Ilmahenki, he saw a figure standing on the far bank, barely observable against the wall of forest that covered the high hills across Deep River to the north of Ilmahenki. It was Vasutati, the name given to the old Indian woman by the Finnish immigrants. It meant Auntie Basket. Every 2 or 3 weeks, Vasutati made the rounds of the farms and the logging camps, selling her hand-woven baskets. She was the last of the Inisal Indians, a small tribe of Chinookan speakers who had lived on Deep River until they were decimated by European diseases. Inisal is where the name Nacelle comes from. Ilmarie hesitated, then raised his hand in a tentative greeting. She stood there for a moment, and then she too slowly raised her hand. It seemed to him that the distance between them, the river itself, shrank to nothing, and he was captured by dark, solemn eyes. Then the woman turned into the forest and disappeared. He continued toward the house in the twilight, puzzling over the incident. In a surge of longing, he imagined a wife coming to the door to greet him. He sighed and went in. The house had no curtains at the windows, no cupboards to hold Sunday dinner dishes, no furniture other than utilitarian wood chairs. The knitted wool cap that his mother had made him 6 years earlier hung tattered on the wall. A good wife would have been embarrassed to let him out in public with such a rag on his head. He glanced at the dirt floor, devoid of the ubiquitous rag rugs that Finnish women seem to turn out in endless profusion, all the while catching up with their neighbors, gossiping, or just quietly weaving them before bed by the embers of the evening cooking fire. If he tossed a pebble in the center of that house, its fall would have echoed off the walls and in his heart for hours. So, any questions?
Yeah, where'd you come up with the idea for the milk whistles and Axel?
Oh, yeah. Sure, but the Baxter Boys. Yeah. Well, there was a myth. I spent a lot of time around Nacelle, and my family, my great uncles, had farms, one right next to the other, like where Nacelle High School is. My great uncle John Pavola, that was his land, and then next to him was my my great uncle Kalle, and next to him was Matti, and next to him was Yuko, who changed his name to John. Farm, all on the north side of the highway and north side of the river. Of course, the river would move around back in the day, but that's where my family came from. And one of the myths that I would pick up on, that I'd hear every once in a while, was about these World War I veterans that had come back and they never married, and they were called the Bachelor Boys. That's very sort of like intriguing to me. And that on Armistice Day, now Veterans Day, flowers would appear on the graves of the Bachelor Boys, and no one knew who put the flowers there. And so that got in my brain, the myth of the Baxter Boys. I was reading at Cannon Beach just this summer, and a woman in the audience raised her hand and she said, "My grandmother was one of the girls that put flowers on the graves of the Baxter Boys." Isn't that amazing? Yeah, wow. And the elk thing, that actually happened to one of my aunt Nona Hillis, who taught at Nacelle High School, and had a shirt tail relative that did come up with the idea of selling elk teeth. He had found, I guess if there was like a sudden disease that would hit a herd or something, and the bugles have ivory on them. They're the only, I think, outside of a walrus, the only North American animal that actually has ivory on a tooth or an appendage. And she said that everybody thought they were bootlegging because he suddenly showed up with this money, and he wouldn't tell anybody where he got it because he was worried someone would find his stash of dead elk. And so that went into my idea about, and I embellished it a little bit, but back in the day, in that time period, the Elks Lodge did have pendants of elk bugles, and they did sell them in like catalogs and mail order and stuff. So that's where that idea came from. Well, yeah. First of all, I put it in the book here. I apologize to all the residents of real Deep River. I said I just couldn't name a novel Nacelle. I mean, it was hard enough getting some guy in New York to, buy a name like Ilmery. It's like, and honest to God, I mean, they wanted me to change their names to American names. They said these are going to be too hard. I said it's about Finns. I can't call them Chuck. I won that battle. I lost some others. But what was the question? Oh, sure, absolutely. It resonates. I mean, one of the things that I think is true is that we deal with symbols because we can't speak. Our language doesn't cover it. I mean, a symbol is something that's like, I think of it like transformers. In the novel, I talk about tributaries to waterfalls. Some of these things are so powerful that you can't get them. I mean, it's like drinking from a fire hose. I mean, it's just too much for us. And Deep River has this wonderful spiritual to it about going across the river. It's about God. It's about death. But I don't have to explain it like I'm trying to do now. You just do Deep River, and I think people feel what it does. And the Columbia River is enormously important to this novel because, I mean, I have a whole introduction to the part two about the river's flow and its life. It's the cycle. It's like it goes out to sea, it comes back and rains on the mountains, and the salmon fry go out to sea and come back as full-grown fish. And so the cycle of life. And it's a lot about birth. I mean, there's a lot of midwifery and birth in here and death. And so Deep River evokes the symbolism of that. Yeah.
Carl, some of the public relations for the book and press releases, including, I think, the advertisement for the Columbia Forum, described the book as the story of three Finnish brothers. You mentioned a sister. Yeah, it seems to me that I know as the essential character of the book.
Totally, yeah. No. I mean, she is the principal character. She's the heroine. I mean, he said that there are some articles that said that the novel was about three Finnish brothers, and he said, but isn't Aino the principal character? Is the sister? Absolutely, it's about her. It's her character arc. I mean, she goes from being a true believer, and causes a lot of wreckage because of her idealism and her fanaticism in a way, which we understand. I mean, she was tortured. I mean, you know, we have reasons for her being this way, but it's about her finally coming to understand that it ain't gonna work this way. And the counter to her, of course, is Axel, who's just the opposite. He doesn't want anything to do with corporations or big unions. He wants his own fishing boat. And it's almost what's the right word? Allegorical of what we face in our country today. We have the individual, right? And then we have the collective. And everybody goes like, well, this is the one that's right. No, this is the one that's right. I'm sorry, we need them both. Come on, you guys, we have to have them both. I mean, if everybody was over here, we'd make a lot of mistakes. And if everybody was over here, you know, I mean, we would have no community. I mean, so Aino and Axel, it's almost an allegory. That as her character arc goes on, they finally can come together. And that's the symbol of the joining of the individual and the collective. There's a lot of capital F feminine, capital M masculine symbols, and that's the dance. You know, the dance is very important to the symbology of the novel as well. Right here. Can I tell you what I'm working on next? I took Arnie, who was a four-year-old boy, in Deep River. And if you remember, he's banging pots and he's shouting, kill the Boche, in the First World War. Well, he ends up going to West Point. And he goes through World War II and becomes the military attaché to Finland in 1947, when Finland is in danger of going communist. And it has Russian troops. The treaty, after they lost the continuation war, they had to cede military bases in addition to a lot of land. There was a lot of land that they lost along the edges, but they also had to give islands and military bases that were garrisoned by Russian troops and Russian Navy fleet. And this is after the war.
And so that country was very close to going communist, and that was one of the big, you know, question marks. And young Arnie meets a Russian military attaché, and it turns out they had met on the Enns River in Austria right at the end, and they were allies then. And these are two professional military guys. They don't deal with politics. They're military attachés. They're there to find out, you know, like, you know, where are the bridges, you know, where are the airfields. That's their job, to do things like that. But they get drunk at an embassy party, and he's in the 10th Mountain. He's a good cross-country skier. The Russians from Russian ski troops, they're both great cross-country skiers. They challenge each other to a race from the Arctic Circle to Helsinki. I haven't figured out exactly how far I can get them in so many days, but there's two rules. One is that's where you start, and there's an ending place, and the other is you can't use any roads. So what this means is that once the race starts, no one will know where they are. It's not just about this race, it's about their two wives. The Russian has a wife, has a couple of small children, and she is world weary. She's been through the siege of Leningrad, she's seen the horrors of German occupation, the war, she's lived through all that. She's the same age as the American wife, who's from the University of Kansas and was a sorority president and has never been outside of Kansas, except she went to Kansas City, Missouri, no, St. Louis. And at that time, there were massive numbers of orphans. There were a lot of orphans left behind from German soldiers, because Finland allied with Germany. They weren't on our side. I mean, they were forced to, because they had to fight the Russians, but that's why they allied with Germany. They were bombed out. There were orphans there all over Europe. It was a horrible problem. And so Louise, who is the wife of Arnie, decides that she wants to help the orphanages, and you know, she's a good-hearted Midwestern American girl. And she comes up with the idea. The two guys are not advertising this. It's just between them. It's sort of like an arm wrestling at a bar. It's just between them. They don't want anybody to know about it. They're going to figure out how to get away with it and just see who wins. Well, she knows about it, obviously. And so she decides to raise money for the orphanage by holding a raffle so that people can choose what the time difference between the winner and the loser, and I call the title the winner, what the time difference is, and that person will win a prize, and all the money will go to help the orphanage. And so she thinks it's going to be a great idea, and she goes to the Finnish newspapers to advertise it. The Russian wife is horrified, because if her husband loses, this is Stalin and Beria, this is the secret police. I mean, horrible, horrible time to be in the Soviet Union or Russia. If he loses the race, he'll be killed, probably, because it'll be just too much. The Russians are trying to bring Finland into the fold. They can't afford a humiliation like this. The Finnish newspapers pick it up because it's symbolic of Finland against Russia, which they can never talk about openly because there's Russian troops in Finland, and they have to do this very careful walk, which they had to do for decades. The word is Finlandization, I think, where you have the Russian bear right across the border. You don't do anything to upset it. And it sort of goes the equivalent of viral in 1947, becomes a cause celebre in the big newspapers. Well, the Russians decide they can't afford to lose this one. So they send out secret police to try and find Mikhail and kill him. And nobody knows this. And Louise realizes what's going on and is horrified, but she doesn't know where they are. She can't find them. So the novel is full of this tension about, will she find her husband? If she does find him and tells him to throw the race, will he throw the race? Will the NKVD find Mikhail and kill him? And, you know, and anyway, that's where I am with the novel right now. Yes.
Which character do you regret having to leave out of
the novel? The question was, which character do I regret having to leave out of the novel?
I had a character named Vaino, who was Vainamoinen, who was the old sage, and I had to cut him out. And I also had another brother, Jukkahainen. So what I did, clever author, is I took that brother and made him Aino's love interest, Jukka. And Jukkahainen was a minstrel, a magical minstrel. And Vainamoinen, like I said, was an old sage and a very powerful shaman. And what I did then with Vainamoinen, Vaino, is I combined him with Ilmari. So I have the smith with a character arc. Someone in the back there?
I'm curious, have you ever been to Finland? And my cousin Nancy lives in Finland and wanted me to ask you whether you think the book will ever be translated to Finnish, because many people there would love the book, she said.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I've been to Finland. My family comes from Kaustinen, a lot of Finns around here. They're related to the Penttilas and the Virkkalas, and you know these names. My grandfather, the Swedish speaker, is from a little town called Skaftung, which is south of Christian and Kaupunki. I love those names, don't you? Christian and Kaupunki. It's a great name for a town. Better than Seaside, you know, Seaside. And I have been there. I went there a couple years ago and tried to find my grandmother's and grandfather's houses. And this is interesting because I had a picture that a friend of my grandfather's had painted for him of his childhood home. And that picture is in our living room. It's on the wall. And so I took a picture of it and I went to Skaftung, and south of this little town, and showed it to people, and they were all scratching their heads. And it's on the seacoast, and there's a little island across, and a fishing boat moored right in front of his little cabin. It's a tiny little place. And I thought it'd be easy to spot this thing. I mean, he said he was from Skaftung. It's not that much seacoast there. Never found it. Well, it got in the local papers, you know, Americans trying to find grandfather's home. I mean, unbelievable, you know, a small town. And somebody who had gone to school with one of my cousins knocked on our hotel room door and introduced herself, and she said she was a friend of my cousin's who had moved to Sweden. And she said, I'll get in touch with her, and I'll find out exactly where that place is. So they did, and she told her where it was. It's about 500 yards from the seacoast now, a half a mile. And it's because Finland is rising. After the glacier melted, all that weight of the ice has come off, and it's bouncing back. So when they say real estate, they're not making any more of it, go to Finland. And I found my grandfather's house, and I found my grandmother's farm, but her house had been torn down. But there were people around there that remembered my grandmother, not from when she left. She went back when she was in her 80s, and apparently made quite a splash. So because everybody remembered her. What?
Would you spell the town?
Kaustinen? Kaustinen. Kaustinen. And God only knows how you spell Christian and Kaupunki.
And will your book be translated?
Oh, you know, if we translate it into Finnish, God, I mean, it's going to be this big. But I hope so. I have no idea. One of the issues there is that the English publisher has the European rights for English version, so many Finns speak English that they just might not think it would pay to try and put a Finnish version out. I just don't know what will happen with it. It's been being translated into Dutch and into French and into Italian right now, so it's gotten some traction in some of the foreign countries. We just have this one.
Carl will kindly stay around and sign your books if you would like. Thanks very much. That was really interesting. I really genuinely appreciate it. We have coming up on February 18th, Steve Forrester talking about the life of Richard Neuberger. He was one of the most consequential Oregonians of the first half of the 20th century. He was one of America's most prolific published writers. In 1954, Neuberger became the first Democrat elected by Oregon to the U.S. Senate in 40 years. He was also the second Jew elected to the U.S. Senate. Forrester, who is the founder of this event, is working on a biography of Neuberger, whose appearance will be included in a book called Eminent Oregonians early next year. So Steve will be addressing Columbia Forum and talking about Richard Neuberger and a really interesting time in Oregon history. With that, I'll turn you loose on the author. Thanks very much again for attending. I hope to see you in February.